Hi everyone, David here. Thank you so much for listening to What Matters. We hope you enjoy today's show. Before we begin, just a quick word on how you can access the rest of our essential journalism on Foresight Climate and Energy. If you, and maybe some of your colleagues, would like premium access to the What Matters podcast and the rest of Foresight, join our global community by becoming a member. You can try us for 30 days for less than €1 a day, which will give you access to our new website and app. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to www.foresightmedia.com to find out more.
Hi everyone, this is Kira Taylor, the producer of What Matters. Just to let you know that we'll be taking a quick Easter break after this episode. But never fear, we'll be back at the end of April with more deep dives into the energy transition. In the meantime, why not check out our sister podcast, Policy Dispatch, or our daily news podcast, The Jolt. Thanks for listening and enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to What Matters, the podcast from Foresight Climate and Energy that monitors, reports and verifies the global energy transition. My name is Kira Taylor. I'm the producer of What Matters and host of Foresight's daily news podcast, The Jolt. I'm stepping in for David, who's off for a couple of weeks. For today's podcast, I'm joined by Michaela Hall of Agora Energy Vendor. Hi, Michaela, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Great to have you here. This week, we're rocketing into ways to measure methane emissions from space. Methane is an extremely damaging greenhouse gas. In the short term, it is significantly more potent than carbon dioxide. So finding and stopping emissions is a key way to help limit global warming. Countries are beginning to look into the methane problem. Over 150 have signed up to the Global Methane Pledge, committing to reduce global emissions by 30% by 2030, based on 2020 levels. But you can't monitor or fix what you don't know. And in today's episode, we're going to talk about a new satellite helping to keep track of methane emissions. MethaneSat was launched earlier this month and boasts unprecedented resolution and precision. Our guest today is Daniel Zavala, a senior scientist at the Environmental Defence Fund, which is behind the satellite project. Daniel, welcome to What Matters.
Hi, Kira, and hi, Michaela. Thanks for inviting me.
It's great to have you on. So maybe let's start with, why is it so important to reduce methane emissions?
Yeah, so when we think of the climate emergency, our mind usually goes to think about carbon dioxide and decarbonization, which is it's the right place where our mind should go and our body should follow. But then the thing is that carbon dioxide is not the only greenhouse gas. There's other gases and species that also contribute to the warming of the planet. And one of them, which is the one that has the second kind of highest contribution, is methane. As Kira, as you were pointing, the few decades after it's being emitted is significantly more potent than carbon dioxide. But more importantly, a good way of thinking what each of them is doing to the atmosphere, carbon dioxide is telling us how much the planet is going to warm. That's why when we think of carbon dioxide, we think of 100 years. And methane is telling us how fast the planet is warming. So in that sense, if we act on methane, it's like hitting the brakes on the climate emergency, and not doing on methane is accelerating climate change.
I really like this explanation. Never has anyone explained it to me like that. I like this allegory, really nice. So why? I just read that the IEA just reported a funny term, so I'm not sure what they meant, but they say near record high emissions on methane. While they also say there's a lot of talk and we think 2024 will be bullish. So how do you explain this? We would have to be really fast because we see the impact of climate change. We started talking about it. That I have to say, I think it has become, at least on a global level, it is a topic that is present. It was in the COP, etc. But how do you explain this? And how fast could we put our foot on the brake if we wanted?
Right. And I agree, Michael. I think it's encouraging to see that the conversation is happening, right? And that's probably, hopefully, will be followed by actions. The thing with methane is, again, because it disappears from atmosphere in roughly a decade. It gives us this opportunity to have a near-term impact on the climate. But the other thing, and this came from a modeling study that EDF did a few years ago, the same level of action in reducing emissions, if it were to happen 2030 versus 2050, has different impacts on the climate. As you say, I mean, the vulnerability and the need for adaptation is there. Around the world, we see frontline communities suffering harsh impacts from climate emergency. So we don't have excuses not to act quickly, and we cannot wait for the responses to appear at the end of the century. It needs to be now. So it's really on this next one or two decade where if we reduce methane using technologies that exist today across sectors, we have a really good chance as a society to adapt to climate change.
That's really interesting because there are a lot of countries that are beginning to look into this. But I mean, like we've said already, this is something which is much newer than tackling carbon dioxide emissions. Which countries are you seeing leading on this? I know the US and the EU has policies on this. Are those the countries and regions that you see leading on tackling methane emissions?
So I think the EU and the US are good examples, not the only ones. One interesting thing, taking a step back, is so when we think where is methane coming from, right? So the main industries or sectors would be the fossil fuel industry, so oil production, gas production, but also coal. Then we have waste management, like landfills, and then we also have the agricultural industry, mainly livestock. And so across those different sectors, and there's also natural sources, but across all those sectors, there's different well-tested, technologically feasible solutions that could be implemented today. The interesting thing when we focus on oil and gas is that most of those solutions are at relatively low cost. Why? Because the gas that doesn't escape to the atmosphere is at the end of the day the same product the industry is trying to sell. So they recover the cost of implementing measures. So that's where, when we think of who's doing things, I think a lot of what we see is governments that are looking at reducing oil and gas methane emissions. So, and that's where we see useful leadership from the EU, from the US. Canada is another one. There's other countries that over the past 1 or 2 years have also implemented mitigation, like Mexico, Colombia, Nigeria. So we start to see a lot of regulatory action to control oil and gas methane emissions, because there's no excuses to have emissions from the oil and gas industry.
I have to say, I start to get a bit tired working on the energy side of the methane problem, of hearing always they are all cost effective and still nothing happens. Why? And whom do I then talk to in order to make it happen? Because with methane, it's if you work on energy, I discovered methane recently, I realized it's more complicated, because you have the companies and the governments in other areas, be it energy efficiency, you know, it's the governments only. So it's a bit, it feels to me that it's a bit more tricky. But if everything is so cost effective, why does it not happen? Why did it not happen when we had super high prices after the Russian invasion?
I think that's a great question, Mikaela. And I keep different stakeholders asking it over and over and over, right? And I think my answer to that is that it's I think, a combination of things. One that we've already been talking, the three of us, is just until very recently, methane remained invisible, both as a molecule, right? So, I mean, it is invisible. That's why new technologies are useful. But even as a discourse, no one was talking about methane, right? So, and then it was easy for industry to say this is not a problem. And there was no data to show if it was or was not a problem. Then the other thing within what you're telling me within the industry, I also think that, and the IEA touches a little bit on this, there's always this competing priorities and competing projects that require investment. So even if methane makes sense as an investment, it's always being compared to other other projects that are not necessarily climate optimized problems, right? So there's going to be competing against other problems, which might be increasing or maximizing production. And so in that sense, I think it might never fall to the place where it needs. And I think that also speaks why voluntary action might not be sufficient, right? So you need a strong regulation that pushes those low-cost solutions to actually be implemented. And then the last thing there, I think that we hadn't had and we now have, is transparency. So transparency in the sense that to the extent that actions are taken, we can make sure that they are reducing the emissions, are not just paper or words.
Now we are approaching the big topic of today, because as Kira said, not with the satellite. Can you explain a little bit, because you recently arrived in Brussels with EDF, right? Not everyone knows you. Most confuse them with EDF France, still in Brussels. Well, and now you come here and you're an NGO with satellites. Explain a bit, and also picking up on what you just finished saying, what do you have to do, or what did EDF have to do in this emerging transparency? What was your role in that?
Yeah, so we're an international organization with decades of experience working in different regions. And what I think sets us apart as an environmental organization is three main things. The first one being science-based. So in the sense that the topics we're advocating for is not just only using the latest science to figure out what's our position to be, but actually, and that's the methane story, when the science is not there, creating the research and catalyzing the science to get us the answers we need. If we look at methane from oil and gas industry 15 years ago, the question was, we don't know how much the industry is being emitted, right? So it triggered this decade of research that EDF was at the center of it, of thinking, what is the type of instruments, what is the type of technologies that allow us to understand the magnitude of emissions, but also know where they are coming from, and eventually, which now we will be able to do, benchmark how different producers are emitting. So science-based being one, talking about Environmental Defense Fund. The second one, this acknowledgement that we need to bring the different players to the table, especially on complex topics like energy and climate, right? So it is about the regulators, but it's also about the responsibility of industry. And it's also about the frontline communities that are receiving harsh impacts. So by bringing everyone to the table, we can find solutions. And the third one is looking for this win-win propositions. And again, methane is a great example, right? Win-win in the sense that, yes, there's a climate benefit to eliminating methane emissions, but there's also an energy security benefit, an economic benefit in terms of if you plug leaks and those leaks becomes supply gas to a region like Europe, then it's a proposition that starts touching very different aspects of current conversation. So I think those three topics, those three elements sets us apart. That's the way we present ourselves in Europe. And again, I think methane, if we look at the history of how we looked at it and where we are today with the satellite, is a great example of what this science-based policy relevance advocacy looks like.
And I'm really interested by the satellite because from reading a bit about it, it's not the first satellite that's going to be looking at methane emissions, but it's going to be the most progressed in terms of the data that it can collect. And it's going to be the first one, if I'm not wrong, which actually will make that data publicly available. How does that work? How does the technology work? And where's the data going to be available for people?
Yeah, so the thing is, so you have a wide ecosystem of satellites right now that it's already monitoring methane, right? And we see in the newspapers the stories of what they pick, and it's great. We see the value of making an invisible problem visible. But it's really what they see is really the tip of the iceberg, right? So they see those massive leaks like this well blowout that we had in Kazakhstan last year that lasted, I think, 200 days. So tracking that, it's very important, and those emissions shouldn't be happening. But that's just a little part of the problem. So what this decade of work allowed us to do is to design an instrument that it's fit for purpose. So exactly what we need to track the changes in emissions from the industry. And then it's important to recognize that the measure of success for MethaneSat is not perfect data. The measure for success is that we reduce emissions by 75% by 2030, right? So it's about mitigation. And so, Kira, it gets to your question, right? So a very powerful instrument, the most precise instrument right now in space to measure methane, in the healthy satellite that it's already orbiting the Earth. But that's the first part. The second part is the process and algorithms that deliver reliable open access data to the different actors that need that data to reduce these emissions, right? And so usually I've done studies with other satellites, and it's taken us almost 1 or 2 years to process the data. That's not fast enough. I mean, the climate emergency doesn't allow 2 years of data analysis. So now the data will be processed in a few days, and then will be released in our web portal so that, again, already as emissions data, not as a scientific product, regulators, industry, investors, frontline communities can look at that data and make decisions.
And is I understood it, it's already up there circling. Really? Okay.
It's already up there circling. It's on the initial commissioning calibration phases. But we have a healthy satellite out there with a very powerful instrument. And we're eager to start getting the data and analyzing and looking for solutions.
Huh. And so by the time we need to know what the upstream emissions for gas are in various spots of the world, let's say for hydrogen rules in the summer, you would already have first input, or is that too ambitious a timeline? Not sure how long this takes.
Yeah, so this first stage, I mean, there's going to be some initial data collection, obviously, to test and check the quality of it. We expect that there's going to be an initial release of data probably closer to the end of the summer. And this is not, I mean, the satellite is designed to map 80% of global oil and gas production. So the vast majority of production regions, both onshore and onshore, are going to be mapped continuously. So 3 to 4 days on average. That's not what we're going to see in the summer, right? So the summer is this initial quick look at a few regions that show how this powerful data looks like. And then what we expect is really towards the end of the year, beginning of 2025, the satellite gets to this sort of steady state collection, data collection and data processing. And that's where we are going to see sort of the flow of data reflecting this 80% of global oil and gas production.
And what do you expect to find? Do you expect that you will find for every place, even those that say we are low, it will be higher than they report because that's how it has been in the past? Or what do you expect to find?
Well, it's, Mikael, it's a very interesting question, right? It is true that on a decade where I personally have been involved in several studies directly measuring methane emissions, over and over, every place we measure, emissions are higher than reported or inventory suggests. So that tells us something. But the reality is also that it's really just a handful of regions around the world that produce oil and gas where we have good data. This is also because I think one of the key take-home messages for the audience today is that with methane, direct measurements is essential. We know that if the accounting of methane is based, as it's done historically, on engineering calculations, models, emission factors, it's going to be wrong. you need direct measurements to understand the real magnitude. So that's what we're getting with MethaneSat. We don't have it for most of the world. So I think it's going to be interesting, to your previous point, Michaela, to start to see how does this different supplier regions compare. So what's the methane intensity of the Permian gas in the Texas in the US that we know have a high methane leak rate? How does that compare to gas being produced in North Africa or the Middle East? That's a question that I think everyone wants to ask and have an answer. And until today, we don't. We'll soon have an answer, but we don't have it yet.
Oh, this is really exciting. I have to say, this is really exciting. I want a satellite too.
We all want a satellite. It's so much fun. We can monitor so many things. I mean, particularly when it comes to the climate crisis.
And that's the other thing, right? I think to the point you two just made, we like to think that MethaneSat is the beginning of radical transparency, and specifically climate transparency. We need this level of understanding with transparent, reliable, open data to track the actions that governments and industry are promising in terms of the wider climate problem, right? So this is bigger than methane. I think it's setting up how the conversation should move forward as we get real about climate action.
Hi, everyone. David here again. Thank you for tuning in to Foresight Climate and Energy. Remember, your engagement shapes our content. So share your thoughts and keep the conversation going on our new website and app. Not a member yet? You can give us a try for 30 days for just €29. Go to foresightmedia.com or follow the link in the show notes. Now, back to our conversation.
It's interesting that you mention and you bring in the government side of it there. How do you see MethaneSat impacting on things like the US policy? And do you think it could be something which helps the implementation of, say, the methane regulation in the EU?
The answer is yes. I think there's interesting policy developments on both sides of the Atlantic. So as you say, in the US and also in Europe, with this performance standard type of regulation, right? So regulations that allow operators to implement measures to reduce their emissions, and then what the regulation is checking, if the emissions are low enough or below a threshold. And up until recently, we couldn't implement those regulations because we wouldn't know for sure if an operator had low enough emissions or not. And now, with data like MethaneSat, you could get enough clarity and transparency. For example, in the US, it's with the methane fee. So the methane fee sets for oil and gas producers, emissions need to be below 0.2%. So 0.2% of the methane of the emissions compared to their production.
Upstream, right?
Upstream. And there's a different one for midstream and downstream. But so if an operator emits above that, they need to pay the fee. So we really want that assessment to be based on direct measurements and transparent data. And that's where MethaneSat enters into the picture, because you can use MethaneSat to look at the production happening across oil and gas basins in the US and assess, are the operators really below 0.2% or not? And I think it's the same thing in Europe with what we see in the recent EU regulations and the intention to get into the imported gas to Europe, which is the bulk of the emissions, right? So then what you want to be able to do is to compare gas that it's coming from the main suppliers, right? So Norway, Qatar, US, Algeria. What is the difference in methane emissions? And again, it's not just numbers that are reported, but valid numbers. And valid numbers here needs to be based on direct measurements.
But those differences are huge, right? You have an idea, just for the non-specific methane experts, I mean, between those countries, what's the variation between the best one that comes to Europe and the worst one? Excluding Russia, because we don't want it anymore, right?
It's a huge variation, absolutely. It's a wide range, and And I would say a range with a lot of question marks, right? Because for the majority of the regions we would want to know, we still don't know. So that's one of the things that I'm really excited about methane sat data. Getting that complete mapping and colors on intensities. Again, speaking about ones that have been directly measured, for example, with data from UNEP's International Methane Emissions Observatory, we know that the offshore production in a region in Norway has relatively low emission intensity. I mean, in the ballpark of this 0.2%. And then the other side of the spectrum, just as an example, we have regions like the Permian Basin in Texas that it's emitting more than 4% of its production. Mexico, it's emitting almost 5% of its production. And what we do know is again, that this, I mean, for the audience that hasn't been following the methane conversation, 5% might still sound like a very small amount of emissions, but we know that if emissions are relatively above 3%, natural gas has completely eroded its climate benefit, right? Yeah. So at that point, the role of gas as this fuel that has a benefit on the climate has completely disappeared. So it the other way of saying that is if you have a leak that it's far away from 0.2%, it's really bad for the climate. And we have examples of that.
Are you considering moving into tracking agricultural emissions or waste emissions? Because obviously oil and gas is not the only area where we have emissions of methane, but I mean, particularly agriculture is particularly a bit more sensitive at the moment. Are you thinking about measuring those as well?
I think the question there becomes about, again, in terms of the way we're thinking it for methane sat, is this data to action pipeline, right? I think for the oil and gas industry, the data to action pipeline is very well understood. Again, we have plenty of examples about the simplicity of controlling the leaks. There are studies we've done using infrared cameras where we just try to see, okay, where is the emissions coming from? And there are several examples where there's a storage tank and the tank hatch was left open and the gas is just coming out. The solution is as simple as closing the hatch. Very low-tech solution. It's not happening because the company didn't know the gas was escaping, right? So in a lot of cases, is once you know where the gas is coming out, it's very simple. So that's we want to take advantage for oil and gas. For the other sectors, as you say, they're important in terms of the share of emissions. What we want to do, and we will be actively pursuing that with some of our partners, is understanding what this data revolution means for the sectors, right? So what can we see in terms of livestock emissions with methane sat? And how is that improved understanding of the emissions can be linked to mitigation actions? And so one example of that is that's why the collaboration with the New Zealand government on methane sat is critical. And their interest, because of their main source of emissions being agricultural emissions, is looking at this. So how can the most precise methane instrument in space provide a more comprehensive understanding of ag emissions? So I think in terms of what we start learning about it, we can then figure out what's the full value proposition. And same thing with waste, right? It's not the focus of the mission, but there's interest in collecting data in cities that can help us understand how this can be useful for mitigating emissions from landfills.
Would you then also expect that you would be able to be this granular to see biomethane production? I'm asking this because, as you know, in the EU, there's a lot of effort and push to scale up the production of biomethane. I'm always skeptical when I hear methane as a solution, right? So I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about it. Do you think you will be able to monitor it, or how we could monitor it if it's not with your little baby up in the orbit?
I mean, and I think, I mean, and in terms of your first point, and Michaela, you mentioning that you're skeptical, right? So I think it's the way we think about biogas in general is that not all biogas is created equal, right? And so it requires careful accounting. This gets a little bit to the need for monitoring. And just to give the audience a little bit of more color into what I mean by this is, I mean, you can think of biogas in terms of taking advantage of waste, right? So waste that exists today, and you capture it in some way, and then that's reducing the emissions. So you still can have leaks from the systems that capture, but it's reducing the emissions net. But you can also start to think about crops that are grown to produce biogas, and that also is going to have subsequent leak. And that changes completely, again, the dynamic of the emissions and the climate benefits or impact. So this needs to go into consideration with biogas at a very general term. So what's waste and what's new? And in terms of the monitoring, I think it gets a little bit to the type of emissions. It appears it matters for biogas, but it also matters for the oil and gas industry. So going back to the satellites we have today, some of them are designed to pick this, what they're called point sources. So one specific point in the map, and if it has high enough emissions, it's going to be detected and picked up. But then what you have, either in an oil and gas field with sometimes hundreds or thousands of wells and sources in a region, or you can have a number of biogas digesters also spread, most satellites wouldn't pick those smaller sources that when you add the emissions from them account for a lot. We actually expect that most of the smaller sources, even in the oil and gas industry, are what accounts for the bulk of the emissions. So the big emissions, by all means, they shouldn't exist and they be controlled. But if you're trying to build a full picture of emissions, you need to account for the small sources that add up to a lot. And that's one of the main reasons why methane SAT is revolutionary. So it is picking the big emitters, but it's also providing information on how all these small leaks add up. It's doing that because it's mapping regions of 200 by 200 kilometers, but providing quantification on smaller regions of 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer. So you can then imagine how you start tracking the different sources within this 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer. And that provides the full picture of emissions.
That's really interesting, because I think the instinct is to say, if it's a big emission, we need to look at that. But then maybe we forget some of the smaller ones, which may be ongoing for longer. Have you had any conversations with the oil and gas industry or anyone who's actually interested in using this data to maybe help prevent leaks?
Yes, that's a good question, right? And so we've talked about kind of the regulatory role with something like the methane fee or the European benchmarking regions for from the imported gas. I think for the oil and gas industry, and we should understand that the oil and gas industry is non-monolithic, right? It's very diverse in their methane journey. There's companies that have been thinking about how to monitor and reduce their emissions for a significant number of years. And there's national companies that are just starting their methane journey in right now, right? Or as a consequence of some of the things we saw at COP. And so the needs are very different. But you can see how methane SAT, because the data is reliable, transparent, and free, becomes a first layer of monitoring in a multi-tiered system. So they could potentially use methane SAT to detect, yes, the big emissions, but also regions that have hotspots in terms of a lot of small sources together. So once you know where that is happening, you can, in a more efficient way, use your monitoring resources to send personnel there to look for what's going on and what's the valve you need to fix. So it becomes part of this symphony of monitoring systems that you can even think how it makes the mitigation more cost effective because of how they can better inform where to go look for things.
It's interesting because there's already industry moves towards this. There's the oil and gas methane partnership, and they're 2.0 is the gold standard of monitoring, reporting and verification. Do you have any connection to that through MethaneStat, or do you think you can inform that process?
I think they're complementary, and they're looking at it from two different angles. One is OGMP, which is really encouraging because what it's doing is moving industry into measurement-based reporting, which there's nothing like that to date, right?
And what I find amazing, it's really industry from all the globe. It's not only US.
Absolutely. So, and you can see the challenge of creating such a partnership with such different voices within the industry, but involved, right? So it's moving forward as something that will provide measurement-based data. But it's still useful to have this completely independent data that then provides assurance that the reporting is what it needs to be, right? So I think it's going to help in understand if we see discrepancies in the reporting, if we see differences in the regions, it's this independent data set that by being complete and transparent can build in terms of the comprehensiveness and reliability of the industry self-reported data.
So, and who is this third party that verifies then?
Well, I think one interesting mechanism here is OGMP being a UNEP initiative. There's the International Methane Emissions Observatory that has been created for this role, right? So integrate data, be the core data integrator around the world for methane. So bring together everything that we have and then make sense of it. So here you can imagine that what IMEO can be doing is making sense of the company self-reported data from OGMP by comparing and reconciling with what MethaneSat and all the satellites have put together. So it's creating this full picture, and then you can understand how the different pieces add up or not.
We're beginning to run out of time, but I just have one question, which may be a very stupid question. But we were talking earlier about satellites for doing other things. What do we know about with like satellites measuring carbon dioxide? Are there already ones doing that? And will you have a CO2 sat soon?
Yeah, there's a number of satellites that have been monitoring CO2 for a number of years. I mean, the questions are different, right? So the questions have to do more with global trends in emissions. From a monitoring perspective, CO2 is challenging because you have a lot of CO2 in the background, right? It's more difficult to make sense of the signals. And there's this other assumption that CO2 is not as messy as methane. And what the assumption means is that if you know what comes into the system and then you burn it, you know what comes out. And so it's easier to account and keep track of the accounting for CO2. And I think that's true to a certain extent. I think, again, there's something to be said about for what processes that it's more true and for what systems we need the direct measurements that we're getting from methane. So one could envision that there could be a role for MethaneSat like projects to start to look at CO2 emissions and from other gases. I mean, you can also think of nitrous oxide and N2O emissions, which is another very powerful greenhouse gas that requires more monitoring. So again, this is why I think MethaneSat represents this paradigm shift in terms of climate transparency. And as we get to the world truly moving from words to actions, we need assurance that the actions are, one, happening, and two, happening at the level of ambition we need. And that's where the type of transparency we're going to get with MethaneSat shouldn't stop with methane and trickle to the wider greenhouse gas question.
So finally, for all the guests who come on to What Matters, we ask them to look into their crystal ball about what they expect the energy transition to look like in 10 to 20 years' time. How do you see it looking?
No, I love the question. And I'll ask it as someone that has been working on methane for more than a decade. But I think we are getting, so that next 10 years is the crunch time for make it or break it with methane. Again, both in terms of this is where the if we have the level of action we need, we're going to see a difference. But if we don't have it, that small window of time is going to close. But again, thinking of where we are with the way industry, governments, financial sectors are talking about methane in a serious way, and thinking that we now have the monitoring technology to know where the emissions are happening, I want to think that over the next decade, we've moved in accomplishing this 75% emission reduction in the oil and gas industry that we know is possible, right? So I think I want to think that what we're realizing within the next year or so is that this is really there's no excuses. And without excuses, we move into making this happen.
Before we go, I'd like to invite everyone to say what caught their eye this week. Michaela, let's start with you. What caught your eye?
Earlier this month, there was a ruling of the WTO on palm oil. And first of all, I was surprised that a topic that was 10 years ago so hotly debated kind of fizzles out like this. WTO kind of siding with the EU that this can be done, that you can put a cap, which is what Malaysia was complaining about, and you hardly hear about it. It was kind of fun. You see what I mean? It took me 2 weeks later to find the news, and it was so funny that that's the way this probably ends, or at least for the time being. So that caught my eye a bit belatedly.
I think it's interesting with palm oil now because everyone just looks at palm oil and thinking it's bad. But then, like you say, when these judgments actually happen, they kind of slip under the radar. Daniel, what stood out for you?
Yeah, so the audience will recognize that I think and read of methane a lot. And last week, the International Energy Agency published the new version of their global methane tracker. I think one incredibly important message is they again emphasize that there's the technologies to reduce emissions from the oil and gas industry by 75%. But I think the new statistic that they release is that if you look at the level of spending needed to cover that, it's less than 5% of what the industry was able to make last year. So again, speaking about the no excuses for reducing methane emissions.
That's a really interesting statistic, and we'll link to it in the show notes so everyone can go and have a look at that. For me, the thing that stood out, mostly because I'm just wondering how the engineering for it happened, was the panels that have been put in the Atacama Desert to power the first air traffic control radar station 100% with solar power. I just want to know how they got the solar panels there and whether solar panels work differently at high altitude. I have so many questions about it. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Daniel and Michaela for joining us. If you have any thoughts or questions about anything we've said on today's podcast, you can reach out to us on our Twitter accounts. I'm on @KiraTaylor15. Daniel?
I'm non-existent.
And Michaela?
At CitizenSane1, but non-active these days. But okay, at least existent.
Maybe LinkedIn or Blue Sky as well for you. Thank you to everyone for listening. If you have any questions for the team, you can also tweet the show @WhatMattersPod or email us show@WhatMattersPodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next time. Thank you.